Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Polls are open in Crimea for the referendum to join Russia. An update. And Malaysia Airlines, the investigation expands. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Voting is underway in Crimea on a referendum to break away from Ukraine and become part of Russia. The voting comes one day after Russia vetoed a UN Security Council resolution urging countries not to recognize the results of the referendum, widely expected to confirm joining Russia. The vote has been denounced by the Ukrainian government and its backers as illegal and a violation of Ukraine's territorial integrity. But as VOA's Elizabeth Ayrt reports, feelings among Crimeans are mixed.
Crimeans are taking part in a referendum on joining Russia. Opponents of the vote see it as a sham, considering Russian and pro-Russian forces are in control now, and the new local leadership, which came to power 2 weeks ago, has already declared independence. But for many voters, especially the elderly, the idea of coming back under Moscow's rule is a dream come true. An elderly woman turns emotional after she casts her ballot. It's been 23 years, she says. Don't make me cry. Crimean businessman and ethnic Tatar Ervin Rustemovich is among those who spurn the idea. He says people do not understand that Russia will not keep its promises, adding, any sensible person understands that. Nobody cares about us. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Simferopol.
NATO says several of its websites have been targeted by cyber attacks in what may be the latest development in cyberspace, reflecting the growing tension over Crimea. A spokeswoman for the military coalition said the attack had no operational impact on the alliance. NATO did not say who was responsible for taking down its websites in a denial-of-services attack, but a group calling itself Cyber Berkut said the effort had been carried out by patriotic Ukrainians angry over what they see as NATO interference in their country. Syrian troops have advanced on a major rebel-held town near the Lebanese border as that country's bloody conflict enters its fourth year. State media and activists said soldiers supported by warplanes, artillery and tanks entered the town of Yabrud. Yabrud is the rebels' last stronghold in the Kalamoun region, where government forces have been trying to sever rebel supply lines across the Lebanese border. Speaking in Beirut, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, urged the international community to help end the violence.
The war would stop now if arms and money would not be provided to both sides.
More than 140,000 people have been killed and millions have fled the country since Syria's civil war began in March 2011. South Korean defense officials say the North has fired at least 18 short-range missiles into the sea, the latest in a series of test launches that have provoked criticism from Seoul and Washington. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency quotes officials as saying the missiles were fired late Sunday from the eastern coast of the Korean Peninsula and flew about 70 kilometers over the Sea of Japan. North Korea is not banned from short-range missile launches under UN sanctions and frequently tests its arsenal. Malaysian authorities say the number of countries involved in the search for a missing Malaysian Airlines jet has grown to 25 after it was determined the plane may have flown over several additional countries. The transportation minister says the search and rescue operation increased by 11 countries, noting that the plane could have gone as far north as Central Asia. The investigation is now in its second week and is turning its focus to the crew and passengers after Malaysian authorities said that the Prime Minister said on Saturday there's a high degree of certainty that someone knew what he was doing when he deliberately turned off the communication system.
Near the border between Malaysia and Vietnamese air traffic control, the aircraft transponder was switched off.
Malaysian police have now searched the homes of the pilot and co-pilot and are examining an elaborate flight simulator taken from one of those homes. A stampede in Nigerian government recruitment drive left at least 7 people dead and dozens more wounded. Security officers outside the stadium in Abuja failed to control the anxious crowd. A security spokesman said the number of people showing up to apply for jobs outnumbered what they were told to expect.
The actual number we invited, you are asked as you know, is almost double.
Thousands of people were caught in the stampede, angry about the government's handling of the event. Jobs are in short supply, particularly for the young in Nigeria. I'm Marty Johnson, VOA News in Washington. More news, voanews.com.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
What is known about Abdelkader Ikrima is that he is one of the very interesting figures in the constellation of Al-Shabaab, its Kenyan affiliate Al-Hijra, and Al-Qaeda, East Africa and beyond.
The United States offers a $3 million bounty for each of the three Al-Shabaab commanders.
The success in Nairobi, we have reduced road-based mortalities and drink on alcohol to well by over 24% within the last couple of days, a week.
Kenya 2025, the Road Safety Awareness Campaign.
It's projected that by 2030, 98% of those cases will be occurring in developing countries. And it's really unnecessary because cervical cancer is almost completely preventable.
And a simple test and technology that can save the lives of women in Africa from cervical cancer. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
The U.S. is offering a $3 million reward for each of three Al-Shabaab commanders. The three are R. Abdelkader Mohamed Abdelkader, better known as Ikrima, who was previously accused of planning Westgate attacks, and his deputy, who is only identified as Jafar. The U.S. accuses Ikrima, a Kenyan of Somali origin, of recruiting Kenyan youth into Al-Shabaab. The third person is Yasin Khalid Osman, Yasin Kilwe, a well-known loyalist of Al-Shabaab leader who has also served as commander of Al-Shabaab in Puntland. VOA's Haruna Maruf reached the former coordinator of UN Monitoring Group for Somalia and Eritrea, Matt Braden, in Nairobi, and asked him to explain the significance of this designation.
What is known about Abdelkader Ikrima is that he is one of the very interesting figures in the constellation of Al-Shabaab, its Kenyan affiliate Al-Hijra, and Al-Qaeda, East Africa and beyond. He's one of the individuals who seems to have links with all three networks and has moved quite freely between them. His name came up in association with the planning of the Westgate attack, although that's at least publicly unconfirmed. But Ikrima is by any definition, a senior planner and leader of operations on behalf of Al-Shabaab and has international linkages. So he is considered to be one of the more dangerous characters in the Al-Shabaab network in East Africa.
What about Yasin Kilwe? What do we know about him?
Yasin Kilwe was, for a number of years, the leader of Al-Shabaab in Northeast Somalia. Initially, that group was headed by an individual known as Mohammed Saeed Atom, but he was very much anchored in his own clan, the Warsengeli clan, and was considered a pragmatic nationalist, if you will, aligned with a wing of Al-Shabaab that the current leader, Ahmed Abdi Godane, has moved against. He's eliminated a number of their leaders. And Atom fell out of favor. He was replaced by Yasin Kilwe, who was a Godane loyalist and has supervised Al-Shabaab's activities in northeastern Somalia now for close to 2 years. Before June 2013, Kilwe was reportedly called to southern Somalia and has remained close to Godane in southern Somalia ever since. And so Al-Shabaab Northeast has actually been operationally handled by other leaders. But Kilwe is considered a staunch Godane loyalist and one of the leaders of Al-Shabaab in northern Somalia.
How is he a threat to the United States?
I'm not convinced that Yasin Kilwe and his group pose a direct threat to the United States, at least not the homeland. But they do pose a threat to United States interests in this part of the world, because the United States has been, for a number of years, supporting regional administrations in Somalia the United States has been providing support to Somaliland, which considers itself an independent state, and to Puntland, both of which have maintained a degree of peace and security and have been hostile to al-Shabaab. Yassin Kilwe and his group have been the principal threat to peace and security in the two regions, while al-Shabaab proper, headed by Ahmed Abdi Godane, has functioned mainly in the south. And so to that extent, Yassin Kilwe has threatened not just peace and security, but also foreign NGOs operating in these areas the kinds of activities, democratization, for example, in both territories that the United States and European governments have been supporting.
That was Matt Braden, the former coordinator of UN Monitoring Group for Somalia and Eritrea. He spoke with VOA's Harun Maruf from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Kenya's National Authority for Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse, NACADA, has announced plans to extend the Road Safety Awareness Campaign to all 47 counties in Kenya. John Mututo is the chairman of the authority. He says that this initiative was a success in Nairobi, therefore it was necessary to extend it to the other counties nationwide.
The success in Nairobi, we have reduced road-based mortalities and blame on alcohol to well by over 24% within the last couple of days or weeks. That success is attributed to the inherent fear that people associate both here and abroad on alcohol brew. That's one. Number two is that we still have a few gas station accidents, mainly in our country, and they want to check out what happens there. Why are these drivers behaving the way they do? And why are they causing such severe accidents out there? And the feeling that it cannot be done in the rural area will now be a myth. We'll have them in all the 47 counties.
Now, your office is also planning on acquiring sniffer dogs to help with the drunken driving issue in the country. Some critics might say that this endeavor is a little over the top. How would you react to that?
In a country like Kenya, where generally local men fear big men and the big men syndrome has been blamed for drug trafficking, you need an independent mind like that of a sniffer dog to pick and point that there is indeed a suspect who could be hauling one form of drug or another. So the reason why we want, and not only those sniffer dogs, but we want those that won't understand English, those which won't understand French or any of the other local languages. And Israel was our choice, those who understand Hebrew, so that people cannot persuade the dogs otherwise. What we are saying basically is that we are tightening the noose and do not tolerate anybody of any cadre. Now that we have a president who is totally committed to following law, we take advantage of it and let anybody involved in drug trafficking be brought to book. So that's what we're trying to do.
Other than purchasing more breathalyzers and plans to acquire sniffer dogs, has your office explored other ways to address this issue?
Yes, we have. We have done a very impressive campaign in the past, like you know. Every child knows NACADA. The campaign we have done is really classic, but campaign without coming to put the supply equation to a halt is certainly not welcome news for Kenyans. Kenyans would like to send. So we are having those broad measures to control the supply kind of the equation, and also we are going to work out on the other aspects of demand equation, being able to work out on mass rehabilitation of addicts before they go out of proportion and we are able to control them.
What do you think are some of the contributing factors to drunken driving in the country?
A relatively good communication system. This is the hub of air travel in Africa, like you know. Then the new constitution gives unmeasured freedoms to individuals and has been abused in its entirety in some cases where people nearly have overextended their lives at the expense of the community rights or other individuals' rights. For that reason being that Kenyans are generally well off compared to the rest of East Africans. They have more to spend. If you look at the recent survey, of course, that could be a small figure compared to your country or to some other part of the country. But teenagers alone here are having more income at their disposal or money to spend at their disposal.
John Mututo is the chairman of Kenya's National Authority for Campaign Against Alcohol and Drug Abuse. I reached him by phone in Nairobi, Kenya.
The State Department calls the West African nation of Benin a positive force for democracy, as well as an excellent partner to the United States. But a two-year-old scandal in Benin has found its way to Washington, and now some U.S. funding to that country may be in question. From Washington, reporter Laura Bowman has been investigating.
The plot unfolded like a thriller. Benin's President Bani Yayi accused his former friend of trying to kill him by replacing his medicine with poison. President Yayi says his own niece and doctor tried to execute the plan, and that Benin businessman Patrice Talon was behind it all. Talon was an ardent supporter and financial backer of President Yayi when he ran for and won the presidency in both 2006 and 2011. In one of the world's poorest countries, Talon was one of the richest men. His business was cotton and commerce involving the port of Cotonou. With both men riding high, just what happened?
In implementing reform that President Yayi has put in place in Benin, independent panel of auditors identified that some businessman has won contract in a way that did not really conform with the rule, with the norms in place. And as President Yayi, as you know, is keen in fighting corruption. He has to make a bold decision to take the contract back.
We talked with Benin's ambassador to the United States, Cyril Ogwa. He told us that Talon's self-interest had collided with President Yayi's clampdown on corruption.
When such a contract is taken back, of course, it's a lucrative contract. It can turn anyone against the president.
Several months after President Yayi accused Talon of trying to poison him, he also blamed the businessman for planning a coup against him. So far, Benin's courts have cleared Talon, but the government is pressing its claims through appeal. Meantime, Talon is telling the world that President Yayi is no Democrat, but a dangerous dictator in waiting, illegally imprisoning his enemies and scheming to ban term limits by rewriting Benin's constitution.
And now, Talon's campaign has come to Washington.
He's paying us to put a spotlight on the situation.
This is former Republican Senator Robert Bennett, whose Washington law firm Talon has hired to lobby on his behalf.
This is entirely an effort on his part to have the world come to an understanding of what is going on in Benin and get world pressure to say this must stop.
That report by VOA's Laura Bowman.
American tourists are looking at...
The number of tourists to Africa is on the rise. Many of the tourists are American. Why are more Americans traveling to Africa? For the answer, we turn to reporter Ndimiake Mwakalele.
American tourists are looking at Africa more seriously now as not only a vacation destination, but also a place to do business. These are some of the trends recently discussed at an annual tourism seminar here in Washington.
The Africa Travel Association was back in Washington recently for its seventh annual U.S.-Africa seminar on tourism. Tour operators, airline carriers, and others interested in travel to Africa filled this conference room to learn about the trends and opportunities. Bisa Williams of the U.S. State Department says the U.S. is helping Africa build its infrastructure to attract more Americans.
Our economic initiatives in Africa are complements to our tourism industry. What we're doing in the Power Africa initiative, which is really to expand the access to electricity, increase it by 10,000 megawatts, perhaps over 20 million homes and businesses, really will, number one, give confidence to the American tourist who knows that there'll be enough lighting and security, but will also provide the energy for hotels and businesses and activities.
In addition to improved infrastructure and airline accessibility, ATA Executive Director Edward Bergman says improved perception of Africa is helping boost leisure and business travels.
More Americans are interested in Africa. They're seeing the investment opportunities in Africa. They're seeing strong growth returns. We're seeing governments increasingly following democratic processes that are respecting the rule of law, are putting in systems to encourage investment, and this all helps.
To expose tourists to Africa, ATA holds its annual congress in different African countries. This year, the venue is Uganda, which has made headlines following its ban on homosexuality. The country's ambassador to the U.S., Oliver Woneka, says this should not deter visitors.
This is an issue of culture, okay, in Uganda.
if a man and a man, they are holding hands, they are holding each other, they are walking through the streets, unless they stand somewhere and they say, look here, we are gay, we are homosexuals or whatever, nobody is bothered, you know? So everybody is welcome, nobody will be persecuted.
Bergman says as a tourist body, their aim is to promote understanding, not fuel debate.
There are many issues that are important to the world, that are important to the global community. And again, the tourism industry is one that promotes dialogue. It's an industry that gets people to get to know each other.
Woneka says there's more to Uganda than its stance on homosexuality.
I think the most beautiful Baha'i temple on the whole continent is within Kampala. And we've got the nightlife. And we've got beautiful, beautiful places to go within the city.
Hoping to capitalize on tourists to the region, Tanzania's ambassador to the U.S. and Mexico, Liberetta Mulamula, says her country is also worth visiting.
We have, of course, the safaris, we have the beaches, we have the ecosystem, you name it. And Tanzania is unique in its own way. You know the history of Tanzania. Tanzania has been one of the most peaceful country, democratic.
According to ATA, Africans in the diaspora and youth a key to growing tourism to Africa. African countries are urged to promote what sells best, culture and food.
When Americans travel, they want to experience what it's like to live in a country. They want to experience what it's like to be African. So you got to eat African, and therefore helping countries to market and brand their food so that in a way that way Westerners can appreciate it.
Now the African Travel Association's Congress in Uganda will take place in November.
That was reporter Ndimiake Mokelele. She was reporting on the growth of Africa's tourism industry.
In Africa, malaria, AIDS and childbirth are among the leading killers of women, but there's also another killer, cervical cancer. Viewer's Carol Pearson tells us about a simple test and technology that can save the lives of women in developing countries.
Every year around the globe, 500,000 women develop cervical cancer, and more than 250,000 die. The overwhelming majority of those deaths occur in developing countries. In Burkina Faso, Ajaratu Kinda learned too late that she had cervical cancer.
They said there is nothing else they can do for me here.
A simple, inexpensive test could have saved her life. In developed countries, most women can be screened for cervical cancer with a non-invasive test at a doctor's office. If lab results show abnormal cells, they have options: cryotherapy, killing precancerous cells by freezing the cervix, and in more advanced cases, radiation or surgery. In developing countries, women don't have these options. As a result, in sub-Saharan Africa, women who are HIV positive are surviving AIDS, but dying of cervical cancer.
This is a healthy cervix.
Dr. here. John Varallo is with JAPIGO, a nonprofit health organization.
In a precancer stage, there are no symptoms. There's no pain, there's no bleeding, there's no discharge. Woman feels well. And so, but that's when they need to be screened.
JAPIGO is helping establish programs in Burkina Faso and other countries so doctors, nurses, and midwives can screen and treat precancerous cells in one visit. A solution of simple table vinegar turns precancerous cells white. During that same visit, cryotherapy kills them.
Abnormal areas or precancerous lesions will turn a thick white, and so it's very clear in most cases.
It takes 10 years or more for those cells to become cancerous, and yet cervical cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths among women worldwide.
It's projected that by 2030, 98% of those cases will be occurring in developing countries, and it's really unnecessary because cervical cancer is almost completely preventable.
The World Health Organization calls cervical cancer a leading public health concern. And now, with an inexpensive test, more women can be screened and their lives saved. Dr. Varallo says the procedure is 95% effective. If screening and treatment can become more widespread, there will be no need for women like Ajaratu Kinda to learn that it's too late. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Each year, 1 million babies are born with congenital heart defects. 10% of them do not live to see their first birthday. Due to lack of treatment, most of them in poor and developing countries. An Israel-based organization is working to improve those children's chances for survival. Maria Magello reports on the group's plans to train Ethiopia's first pediatric cardiac surgeon and its efforts to raise money for a boy named Elias.
Since its creation in 1995, the organization Save a Child's Heart has been improving the quality of cardiac care for children in developing countries who suffer from heart disease. For the cost of $10,000, children are brought to Israel's Wolfson Medical Center to get the surgeries they need. Save a Child's Heart Executive Director David Litwack says their team of volunteers helps reduce the cost.
One of these operations in the United States could cost anywhere from $100,000 to $300,000, but for us it winds up being $10,000, and then regardless of how many surgeries they have, or how long they're in the hospital, or how complicated the case is, room and board in a children's home that we built 2 years ago for the child and his or her mother.
But the organization says its ultimate goal is to enable countries to treat their own children.
We made the commitment to do at least 50 children a year from Ethiopia. Equally important is that we have begun training what will be Ethiopia's first pediatric cardiac surgeon.
Recently, the medical group also trained Tanzania's first cardiac surgeon, a process that took 5 years. While 40% of the kids come from Africa, Save a Child's Heart has treated children from 48 different countries, including Eastern Europe, Asia, South America, and the Palestinian Authority. Save a Child's Heart's youth branch chairman in the United States is Michael Brown.
Just this last year, we started bringing children from Haiti, from El Salvador, from Peru, and in fact, this past summer, we started bringing children from Syria. So what this shows you is that we'll go wherever the need is.
Special remarks, Minister Wahid Balai, who is here from the...
Fundraisers and volunteer coordinators make miracles possible for the medical group. This fundraising event in Washington, which Brown helped to organize, is for a special boy.
The goal of tonight is to raise $10,000 to save the life of a young Ethiopian boy named Elias for the surgery that he needs to save his life.
Elias is 15 years old and one of 26 children who are being treated right now in Israel. The event raised more than $10,000, and Elias is among the more than 3,300 children the group has treated in the last decade. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
Thank you.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And coming up in the second half of the program, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital Lagos, music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and indeed relaxation.
And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Respect everyone, we are all the same in the eyes of God. Kokoliroko, olunaku lwakedde banange sebuse kutulo. Banebuuza luchadiye lunomfirira bantu bange. Njagala nfaananeko nga Mandela, we yalwanirira abantu be. Nakedde ku makya ne nkwata enkubo nge ne ngule kasooli ndeko. Kuba makafaananyi nga gwe serebu. Kasuli amutunda yabadde mukazi ayiyambeera abaana babeewo omukazi yeewunyiza nnyonyonyo okukyama ku muddala gwengula kasooli koye kulaba ku TV nkuwulira ku radio zani ali nawe yabadde surprise jali nga mugudde mu kifuba kye mulamuse neyeewuunya obutamwenyinyala bambi Kaba kasoli ko Kwanze gwe nange omwavu omugago munaku Tutonda lyomu Eno meseji yaberaga Tolina choli Tuvoisa mama se yakutonda ye yabatonda Emele kukejese chibuto wogerega bebajirima Vanga komu motoka yeye mnange nubala msaba Abantu oisa mama senta na yowe valijisima Vanga komu hama yeye mnange nubabonga kwa Abali simenta na yote valiva muyenga
Revival Band
Kufula wanja ulo Katiyo gendanga keyo mukafunda Okubabuza kwa utechi kubutula Omugaka tezi kwa mupanga Nenvunye muliateba ya gurini Venera botufa Basima 6 feet under the ground Respect everyone We are all the same in the eyes of God Cause when we die We all go 6 feet under the ground State house yo bote Wanga milioni ya maje Kacha sulamu lusuku yeka Teri ya doa kasala mkuma Omafu no mugaga wetufa Batu batizeli nyali mumulambo Tolina choli Tuvo isa mamase ya kutuna ye ya batonga Tolina choli Mele kugejese chibuto wojele gabe bajirima Banda como mucho calle y yo te voy a regalar Olave mele tujinu na uo Uwozo sula muye nganze mpangi saka tuwe Olava renti mchima uo Waliwa muntu kwe manyinga mwepansi Ngana kutola mumotoka ye Akumba zavu vera Muto jisige bisoto Bojifuluma springa zivayo Sakelelo muimbia ya wanika Mboza simbi na bantu hawa Bantu abo beba kuwanika Basa sule simbi no bayiwa Ono nebisera byabwe Afuna obuvune Entebe nezimenyebwa Tolina
na toli na choli
Amchuwa isa mama se ya kutona ye ya
batonga Toli na choli
Mele kukeje se chibuto wa kereka beba jirima
Toli na choli
Banda komo motoka ye ya muna benugana
Toli na choli
Amchuwa isa mama senta na yo beba lijisima Banda komo hama ye ya muna benugana Chibuto bojereka beba jirima Abali simentana yote wali vamuyenga
Black gold Baba yakuka yapanga jiri ya vita mwana ya gonda Orobosi ya linda yena ya tuwala munomba fumbe Ela ya tuka ya fumba bintu ya sika yena ya uta Omukazi ya mwenda babo yo Ya geda ya nirire enziye unya obabi alia vitolawa Kwari mukwano ayabasada mwege ngereza bakazi
Akuloga kuloga nosimagira kuloga Mwawetso wende ya yongera ya kuloga Akuloga kuloga Magira kuloga Ogweso mkana siri wa erei Omukaza kuloga
Omwano ya sika yuvabiana ya tamu Bosi ya uta Ya molisa kanamba ya kalezika wende Bosi ya gonda Nolundi ya linda Kola chayenda duma ya tunda Ngani wako lebe nditaribu Na bosi wa musiba kantu Mukwano kwa muko izababu
Yesi duwala
Mokazi ya ndoga Muli mbancha linda ya balongo Yake kujiza langa vana vahende
Kuloga kuloga Usimagira kuloga Waweto wende Ya yongera ya kuloga Akuloga kuloga Usimagira kuloga Ogweso mkwana siri waere Iwo mukaza kuloga
Mukazi ya mdoga Yatu mangoyo bulicha enda Nolundi ya linda ya yoye ipera Mwenda kwa buiro Buweli mbula taira Yesu la kulu ye Magi maso kutola kunga gefu mdire Buti iwe wabao
Watuma tuma
Linda balonga
Watuma tuma
Mazola maendi
Watuma tuma
Watuma tuma pepe
Watuma tuma
Watuma tuai
Watuma tuma
Makuli soka lesi
Watuma tuma
Karambe
Watuma tuma
Watututuai
Watuma tuma
Watuma tuma
Watuma tuma
Baba baba
Watuma tuma
Makuli soka lesi
Watuma tuma
And that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa. One man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Flight Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings, the former head of state and government of Ghana, is in the international news again. Perhaps perturbed by the contradictory cacophony of sound bites regarding the Ukrainian and Crimea acute crisis, Mr. Rawlings criticized the African Union and to some extent the non-aligned movement for remaining silent about the dispute. In one declaratory statement, he revealed his deep frustration. He remarked, quote, the hypocrisy and demonstrated inconsistency by some of the superpowers in the Ukrainian affairs is a serious insult to the intelligence of the world. It did not leave much room for doubt about the target of his anger. However, in assessing Mr. Rawlings' outrage, it is necessary to take into account the fact that he served his country at a time when there was great respect for the opinion of the African continent. In the United Nations, even the superpowers consulted the African states. Africa's founding fathers did not shy from commenting on current international disputes, especially regarding the dangerous rivalry between the superpowers in the Cold War. Regrettably, in the post-Cold War period, few are taking the position of the African states seriously. True, when Security Council votes are needed on the Council's agenda, the African states are lobbied for the votes, but that's about all. Mr. Rawlings no doubt remembered when he and other African states were able to tackle major international problems. For example, when the Israeli government in the early 1970s rejected the memorandum of the United Nations envoy, Ambassador Gunnar Yaren, aimed at resolving the Middle East position, the OAU, in quick succession, sent on to Israel two missions to find out from the government why they were against the Yaren memorandum. The results of that mission in Israel set the stage for the decision of the then OAU to recommend to all African member states to break relations with Israel at the wake of the October 1973 war. At the end of the Cold War, the poor economic performance of many African states and the growing dependency on the largesse of Western powers have contributed to lack of respect of African views on international problems. It is interesting that Mr. Rowling is now yearning for the return of the bipolar world, a period in which African views were taken seriously. Owing to the long period that he served as head of state of Ghana, Mr. Rowling understands the essence of geopolitical conflicts and calculations. Therefore, he could well understand what is now going on in Ukraine and Crimea. In the Ukrainian situation, Mr. Rowling felt that at least the African Union should have intervened to caution against the application of sanctions. Other African states have not said anything about Ukraine. Some Africans who have commented on Mr. Rowling did not agree with him. Others do agree with him for the simple reason that many extra African powers do not hesitate to comment on what Africa should or should not do in its affairs, particularly the non-state actors, human rights groups, who are not hesitant to tell Africans how they should go about their business. Nevertheless, the African Union should organize itself better to be able to make comments about international affairs. In the meantime, however, Mr. Rowling should not be discouraged to speak out. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. We are still having problems. We are having problems reaching Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. We apologize for the delay. We'll be able to bring you Nightline Africa Sports as soon as we re-establish contact with Segun in Lagos. Meanwhile, listen to this music. Mario, Nale.
Oh Mario, nasi na peki sayo, kolinga kapesi bazei na mbongo. Yo kandenge azariko kabayo, na mitema ya basipe na mibali. Yo motoze na badiplom mitano Mario, sala kame me foro luka mosala Mario. Pona nini ozako baby saka usambu isakombo nobo Mario. Ah, nalembi.
Ba protinga na pakolaka, zoto ekoma sembe sembe. Boko pete ngana zoka, lobi na swa maladi ya cancer. Lobi tango na kopola yo, kimi na ye. Mario, na ba ye. Mario, na lembi ye.
Ba familia Mario bakanisaka. Mario a pesa kanga mosoro, nzo kanga moto na la tisaka e na le isaka e na la lisaka e. Mario na le mbie e. Bima bima nanda konanga Mario. Bona nini nyongo ya polingo e.
Kupete nga na suwa, epa izuwa ya lokuta, epa izuwa ya biloko e.
Nakuta kinga na yango e.
Kambo moke mo sala kobo ma
biloko ya ndako
era somba na lebie Mario na baye yo ene Mario na lebio
Mario okutinga na biloko mo bali mo suso somba oyo kelingi akofana te Mario oyo kelingi te olia na mesa. Kaka soki zue kangyo na poitrine, oliaga kopeta ngai nako boma biloko. Mario, sina salisa yo mingi. Diploma simangamu na salisa kiyo Mario. Bongo leyonga kumi mwasi mabe, Mario likambote. Ah, mokilie, ezaka kaboye.
Mobale akutinga na bomengo asengi ya komandenga na nimi. Mobale akutinga na bangenge asengi ya dirijenga na nimi. Na bandiko bima na ye,
babandiko penga ye, monsieur.
Mario abimi moto, akanisi biloko na ngai ya ye. Mario, na ba ye yo. Kende Mario, na lembi yo.
Mario azongi epe ya baboti, akuti mbeto na ye ya bomwana. Eko mitango akolala mbeto mokuse makolo milai Mario. Mario na lembi Somba mbeto na baye Mario na lembi
Koyoka motema pasite ndakonga moko na futaka. Ila mana sombela yo natikeli yo souvenir ya bolingo. Salina lavage, na cotine la yon a bateau. Mario, na lembio. Kende na yon a baye yo.
Mario. Mario. Mario mosala ko bete nga bana di koko. Banango ya yo. Olingo beba mama mobokoli.
Epa izuwa ya lokuta, epa izuwa ya biloko. Akuta kinga na yango, ikambo moke mosala kobo mabilo.
Yes, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go straight to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun on the Delta DMA. Good evening, Segun.
And good evening, Africa. Good evening, Douglas, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, March 16th. Ghana kicked off on a winning note at the 2014 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup, which started in Costa Rica on Saturday. The Black Maidens, as the Ghana team is known, defeated the 2012 FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup finalist North Korea 2-0 in their Group B opener. North Korea started promisingly and dominated early possession, but it was the Africans who scored with their first real attack when Jane Ayeyam slotted home from 12 yards for her fifth goal in her sixth under-17 World Cup match. Ghana doubled its advantage 6 minutes into the second half through striker Sandra Owusu-Ansah, who was named the player of the match. Another African team, Zambia, which was in action also on the opening day, was however not so lucky. The Chiapulopulo of Zambia lost 2-0 to Italy. Player of the match, Anna Maria Saruturini, who had started the match on the bench, bagged both goals in the tournament's opening match. Overall, three teams are flying the African flag at the tournament, which will run from March 15th to April 4th. They are Ghana, Nigeria, and Zambia. Ghana and Nigeria are playing in their fourth championships, while Zambia is making a debut in the finals. Ghana won the bronze at Azerbaijan in 2012. On their part, the Flamingos of Nigeria have a rich history in the tournament, having twice reached the last eight. Meanwhile, the opening day of the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup proves to be a bittersweet one for host Costa Rica. At San Jose's National Stadium, the Costa Ricans lost 3-0 to their Venezuelan counterparts. However, the boisterous 34,000 crowd at the stadium is a record for the opening match of the tournament. Away from the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup now, Algerian Jamil Belmadi was named coach of Qatar on Sunday. He replaces Fahad Thani, who has been given charge of the Olympic squad. The main goal for the 37-year-old Belmadi, who guided Qatar club L'Equipe to two National League titles in 2011 and 2012, is to qualify Qatar for the 2018 FIFA World Cup to be hosted by Russia. Qatar, which failed to qualify for this year's World Cup in Brazil, will host the 2022 World Cup. Belmadi, who was capped 20 times by Algeria, was born near Paris into an Algerian family. Talking about the World Cup, it is 88 days to the kickoff of the 2014 edition of the tournament, and the countdown continues. The FIFA World Cup trophy tour by Coca-Cola is currently in the process of visiting 88 countries during a 267-day trip around the world. Today, Sunday, Wales will become the latest to get an up-close view of the beautiful game's most coveted prize, with England, the Netherlands, and Belgium next in line. This is the third edition of the trophy tour, which began ahead of Germany 2006 and has proved a huge success with fans around the globe. In other news, former Brazil and Barcelona star Rivaldo officially retired on Saturday after a 24-year career. The 41-year-old midfielder, a World Cup winner with Brazil in 2002, had not been playing at top level for several years. He finally decided to end his career with an announcement on his Twitter and Instagram accounts. FIFA's Player of the Year in 1999, Rivaldo had been playing sparingly for a Mino Brazilian club, Mogi Mirim. He is expected to remain as the president of the club, where his 18-year-old son is now playing. Rivaldo also played in the 1998 World Cup, when Brazil finished runner-up to France. Finally, African runners on Sunday dominated the Seoul International Marathon in the South Korean capital, sweeping both the men's and women's titles. According to athletics' world governing body, IAAF, Ethiopia's Jacob Jasu won the men's race in a huge personal best of 2 hours, 6 minutes, and 17 seconds. Jasso took almost 5 minutes off his previous best when winning the IAAF gold label race. He became the first ever Ethiopian men's winner at the famous race, which can trace its history back to 1931. Kenya's Stephen Chemlani was second in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 24 seconds, a personal best, followed by another Kenyan, Gilbert Kirwa, in 2 hours, 6 minutes and 44 seconds. In the women's race, another African, Kenya's Hela Kiprop, won in a personal best of 2 hours, 27 minutes and 29 seconds. The result is a 33-second improvement from when Kiprop finished fourth
at last year's Berlin Marathon. Ethiopia's Ashu Kassim finished second in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 45 seconds, while Namibia's Hilaria Johannes was third in 2 hours, 28 minutes and 27 seconds. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. Segun on the dot at Adeyemi will be back again next Sunday for another look at African sports here on Nightline Africa.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thanks for joining us tonight. I hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And hope you'll join us again on Saturday. I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many countries around the world, journalists intent on telling the truth about repression, corruption, and criminality must risk their liberty and their lives to do so. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 2013 was the second worst year on record for journalists, with 211 imprisoned and more than 100 killed. In a memorial speech in honor of slain American journalist Daniel Pearl, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power underscored the critical importance the United States places on a free media and the duty of governments to ensure access to information, in part, crucially, so that governments can be held accountable to their citizens. But, as Ambassador Power pointed out, many governments try to corrupt, intimidate, and manipulate the press. Their methods include bribery, parceling out licenses to friends or others willing to practice self-censorship, imposing strict limitations on the internet and social networks, hiring intermediaries to harass and attack reporters and editors, and enacting laws that equate criticism of the government with subversion, terrorism, or treason. Ambassador Power cited several examples, including the case of Chinese reporter Liu Hu, who was arrested in September for defamation after urging authorities to investigate a local official, the arrest of Al Jazeera correspondents in Egypt, and the case of Ethiopian journalist Eskinder Nega, who continued to work online after his newspaper was closed and was arrested and imprisoned in 2011 for protesting the arrest of other journalists under a sweeping new law. From Eritrea and Iran to Ukraine and Venezuela, there are many comparable stories, said Ambassador Power. But, she noted, as Thomas Jefferson affirmed 225 years ago, freedom of the press is the best means of ensuring that all avenues of truth are open to individual citizens, and the United States has made support for press freedom one of the core and recurring themes of U.S. diplomacy. Each day, in ways public and private, U.S. officials make known our backing for the right of people to speak, publish, broadcast, blog, tweet, and otherwise express themselves openly and without fear, said Ambassador Power. After all, she stressed, defending freedom of the press is but one element of a larger struggle, a duty to be advocates for the rights and dignity of every human being.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.